good day, good evening, good afternoon, and good night. Welcome to the program. I am your host, Chris George Zuger, and you have entered the Den of Lore. This is a bonus episode, 31. Wow. This is actually a pre-recorded episode that I had with an impromptu conversation with Robert Bavall, which I have recorded with him prior to our show with Steve Myers. Robert was such a good sport and is a wonderful man. Had a fantastic conversation with regards to the pyramid and its uses. Didn't expect to have to be able to have the opportunity and the honor to have him on the program so suddenly, but we were just going to have a quick chat, and it ended up turning into a full hour where he started asking me to record, and it was just a lot of fun. I would recommend you go check out Origins of the Sphinx, Celestial Guardians of Pre-Pharaonic Civilization on Amazon. This is the new book which he's co-wrote with Dr. Robert Schock of Boston University, good friend of the show as well. And it's available in Kindle as well as paperback edition, which will be released, I believe, the April 18th, 2017. So you can go check that out. And also, again, for anybody who listens to the show, you do know that we do this out of the goodness of our hearts and the fact that we do love it, but doing this show does cost some money. So we are asking for all of our listeners, if you do like the show, you do like the content we have, support the show and make sure that we can stay 100% ad and sponsor free so that nobody can restrict who we can invite on the show and what we can say. You can go to visit denoflore.com, click on support the show at the top right hand corner, or visit our Patreon at patreon.com/denoflore. Also, please don't forget to subscribe to the channel if you are listening, whether it's on iTunes, Google Play, YouTube, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, or on Deprogrammed Radio. This is Chris George Zuger wishing you a good hour and a half journey into the pyramid from one of the great individuals in the field of renegade research and archaeology into our ancient Egyptian history. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the program.
The Orion correlation theory started in 1983, to be precise. I corresponded with various Egyptologists, in particular Sir Ivan Edwards, who at the time, still is regarded as one of the main authorities in pyramid research. He was the curator of the Egyptian department of the British Museum, and extremely well known for his studies on the Giza pyramids and all other pyramids in Egypt. So he was the right person to deal with at the time. And so that's how it started, with a very simple letter, and I was eventually encouraged to publish a article. It was published in, let me get this right, in 1989. So that's when it became public. I published an article in Discussion in Egyptology in Oxford Journal that I think is still active today. And then eventually I published a book in 1994. I co-authored it with Adrian Gilbert. It was published in parallel with a BBC television documentary called The Great Pyramid, Gateway to the Stars. And really that's when it all started, because it hit the public in a big way because of the television program and the success of the book. The book was unexpectedly, for me, I didn't expect it, but it was a number one bestseller in England. It's since then, it's gone into 30 languages. And of course, you know, as all these things, any new idea of this kind will go through the scrutiny of professionals, academics, whoever wants to have a pot shot at it. So it started from the 1994-95, and believe me, I've had as many radio debates and university debates and debates with the ex-minister of antiquities in Egypt and So it's gone through the mill. It's gone through the mill. Mm-hmm. The problem is very often it was either attempts to debunk some very clever ones, or very arbitrary. You know, simply that we didn't like the theory, that Egyptians couldn't have done what the theory suggested, and so forth. So I was very pleased many years later, after all these conferences and debates and challenges, that a university in Italy took it very seriously. In fact, without me knowing, it was probably, I don't know when they started looking at this, but I think it was 2014, mm-hmm. and they decided to grill it through a falsification testing, which I've just sent to you. And in fact, this is the second article they published. What a nice cat.
Yeah, she's my official co-host.
Okay, well, there you are. And I had no idea. They contacted me because they were having problems publishing it in archaeological journals. These two academics are astronomers and professors of mathematics, which is really what this theory is about. I mean, once you've gone through the quantitative arguments about the pyramid texts and whether the Egyptians had the tools and so forth, the only way you can really analyze it properly is because it involves astronomy. You know, and the mm-hmm. attacks were really astronomical in the sense that people were saying, you know, the it's not very accurate, or the third pyramid is not the same intensity as the light of the stars, and it went on and on like this. So the only way to go through it is through what they did, was to see whether it could be falsified or not through a statistical test, which they passed it through the I think the Monaco, they call it the Monaco statistic test. And the other is through astronomical detailed analysis. One of the problems that often was put against this particular theory, I'm looking at your cat, it's really amusing. One of the problems with analyzing this particular theory is that most of the time, astronomers, mm-hmm. I'm thinking of people like Edwin Krupp of the Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles and various others, were quoting coordinates that are taken today with very sophisticated optical instruments. I mean, so the argument was arbitrary, because the only way that the ancient Egyptians could have looked and measured those stars was with the naked eye. They had instruments, but they were all rudimentary naked eye instruments. And therefore, what these people did, the Italian professors, correctly, went through all naked eye observations, the latest, you know, what can be seen, what can be measured, at what degree it can be measured, to what accuracy, and so forth. And based on this, they then passed the whole thing through various tests, and ultimately arrived at the conclusion that they could not falsify it. It's as simple as that. So the theory is unfalsifiable. It doesn't mean it's true or not. Mm-hmm. It stands. And that's as far as you can go with the theory, unless somebody finds a handwritten certificate witnessed by King Cheops saying that he wanted to do this. You know, that's where finally it rests. And there is many aspects of the theory that makes it look unlikely to be a coincidence, because what it boils down to is, are we dealing with a series of coincidences, or are we dealing with deliberation? In other words, did the ancient Egyptians intended to do what we see today, or it's a coincidence? There is no doubt that there is a correlation. The question is it a coincidence? We have support that it's not a coincidence. I'll quote you the main ones. You have First of all, the astronomical design of these monuments. The Giza pyramids and all other pyramids in Egypt, particularly the Giza pyramids, are clearly incorporating astronomical elements in their design and construction. Their base is facing the cardinal directions very, very precisely. And the Great Pyramid has other astronomical alignments, like the famous shafts that shoot out of the king's chamber, north and south, and those shooting from the queen's chamber, north and south. And these, long before I got involved with this, were shown to have alignments to specific star systems. The southern one to Orion's belt, the king's chamber, and the northern one to the circumpolar stars, and particularly the polar star at the time, which was Alpha Draconis. So that's the shafts in the king's chamber. The ones in the queen's chamber were examined by me in such a long time ago, in 1987, mm-hmm. Through the University of Sydney. And it was found through calculations at the time. We didn't have astronomical programs in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. I remember we were working with Apple IIcs in those days. Anyway, the calculations were done manually, and we found out that the southern shaft pointed to Sirius, the star Sirius, which fitted the pyramid texts. In other words, that we were told in the pyramid text mm-hmm. that Orion was the god Osiris and Sirius was his consort, and therefore these shafts, in a sense, expressed the same ideas astronomically. In other words, they were pointing at these specific stars that were mentioned in the pyramid text. So there you are. That's one of the main factors. The other is, of course, the position of the star of the pyramids on the ground. You have two large pyramids and a small one offset. Very similar, almost precisely, but not exactly, but that's because of non-optical observation, to the belt of Orion. Then you also have the relative position of these pyramids and the angle they take with the direction of the Nile, the same way that the stars have with the Milky Way, which again fits the pyramid text, because again we have a landscape that speaks of a celestial Nile and the region of the afterworld being next to it and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that's it. I mean, I was always bemused why people sort of find this difficult to accept. It's become very popular now, but there always will be. What I don't want to encourage is open old discussions. All this has been done a long, long time ago and many, many times. So really, there's no point for me to come and repeat all this all over again. The way it's set now is, well, there's a lot of books published. I've published 15 books. Mm-hmm. The original one was The Orion Mystery, but the theory has been discussed on at least four of my books. one with Graham Hancock, as you know.
She does, she does what she wants to do.
I can see that. She's about to put her tail on your microphone. Okay, anyway, one with Graham Hancock in 96, it's called The Message of the Sphinx. We repeated the whole, many, many articles in popular journals and some in academic journals. God knows how many television programs have discussed this theory or presented this theory since then.
I've probably watched all of them at least a couple of times.
So what Mr. Meyer wants to do, I'm not quite sure, but he's extremely welcome to do it. But I have no desire really to, and frankly, it's old hat for me. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm moving into much more interest. Well, we're taking it to a higher step now, as you may be interested.
Now, have you heard of Edward Nightingale and his work?
Yeah. I know Nightingale quite well.
Oh, yeah. Him and I talk quite often on Skype. Just, you know, if he's doing work or if I'm doing work, we'll chat on chat online just to be able to talk about his theories we've had him on the program for his birthday a couple of weeks ago, and we basically went over a 5-hour period. discussing the entire, you know, his entire correlation. And he seems to kind of be on the ball like you were back in, 93, 94 when this first, came about. And it was interesting. And I know that he was just on Jimmy Church's show, Fade to Black. I linked him up with Jimmy to kind of get more eyes on it, because it takes the natural position of where you started and kind of spins it further outwards into, more of a sacred geometry style versus, versus the astronomical.
Yes, sorry to interrupt, but I know of, in fact, I met Nightingale twice, I think. The last time was where was it, by the way? Yes, it was in Minnesota. In 2014, I think.
Paradigm Symposium, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that's correct. It's the Paradigm Symposium with Scotty Roberts. We had lunch and breakfast together, and he corresponded quite a few times with my brother, who is very much into the geometry of the pyramid. My brother is an architect. Mm-hmm. Let me put it this way. Whoever designed these monuments, mm-hmm. Was expressing his design in mathematical and astronomical manner. He was not using text to explain or to tell us what this pyramid is. We have no texts that exists of the fourth dynasty, let alone of the builder of the Great Pyramid. There is a bit of graffiti in one of the relief chambers, but this has been discussed and rebutted, and it's very confusing. But ultimately, there is no official texts, so we have nothing in writing that tell us what this designer mm-hmm. had in mind. What we have is the product itself, and the product itself clearly shows that he used astronomy, there's no doubt, and he used a complex geometry from which you can extract an amazing amount of information if you know how to read it. And I think that's what Nightingale did and various others. I've just completed a book which will be published at the end of this year. It's in fact written with an astrophysicist.
Wow.
A very unusual collaboration. Professor Chandra Vikramasinghe, who is now retired, but he was professor of astrophysics and astrobiology at Cardiff University and Cambridge University in the UK. He's an extremely well-known astrobiologist. But the interest between us was that he proposed a theory called the panspermia theory with Sir Fred Hoyle, the famous astronomer, back in the 70s. Which is becoming very popular now, the theory that life on Earth was seeded and not spontaneously developed on the planet. It was delivered, if you like, by comets and meteorites. Mm-hmm. And this theory is gaining a lot of support in the astrophysical and cosmological communities these days, mainly because of what we know since the last 3 or 4 years. About comets and the origins of life and so forth. Having said this, he's also, being an astrophysicist, is extremely aware of the latest cosmological theories, the latest astronomical discoveries. We're dealing now with a much larger universe that we had previously suspected. We're dealing with exoplanets. We're dealing now with solar systems since the last 3-4 weeks. The famous solar system TRAPPIST-1 that was found having 7 Earth-like planets. It opens up the huge possibility of extrapolating something like a billion solar systems within our galaxy alone, and therefore the possibility of extraterrestrial life, or much older intelligent life. And therefore the question, which I did not want to touch at all, mm-hmm. I've resisted looking at anything to do with the possibility of these monuments being the subject or the result of an extraterrestrial contact.
I understand where you're coming from. Sorry to interrupt. We're of the mind, is it possible? Sure, anything's possible. It's also possible I could have, you know, a gold house made of gold in a couple of weeks, but it's not necessarily probable. But the panspermia theory, like that's something I'm very highly interested in, and it's a very interesting subject as a whole.
Yeah. Well, let's put it this way. The frontiers of science today, and I'm talking about mostly physics, because this is where the action is. Theoretical physicists, cosmologists, neuroscientists, virtual reality, computer science, artificial intelligence, all these put together, and when you get to the frontier of this, of what is going on, opens up, and of course all these now have to contend, not just with what we call the classical physics, but with quantum mechanics, and what quantum mechanics entails. So all this opens up all sorts of possibilities, and we have to be open up to these possibilities. It is more than possible, it's not confirmed, that there is intelligent life in the cosmos, and therefore it is entirely possible that there is much older life. We know, for example, that our solar system is 4.5 billion years old, and that the cosmos existed at least 10 billion years before. So, I at this stage, anything within intelligent speculation, this is what it's all about. There is crazy speculation, there is speculation that is coming off the hat, but there is intelligent speculation. Today in theoretical physics, in that community of scientists, it's quite kosher to discuss these possibilities, to discuss possible contact, to even discuss the possibility that we are a simulated universe. So these are open. Mm-hmm. And therefore we have to be open about what happened in the past, because whatever exists today has existed since the beginning of time. The fact that we're discovering it today doesn't mean it wasn't applicable in the past. And therefore we really have to look at anomalies, and the Great Pyramid is an anomaly. That's what it boils down to. It's a big anomaly. It's a monument that is of a scale that has always baffled to this day anybody who examines it. It is anonymous, which is very bizarre, to have a monument of that size and importance being totally anonymous. Raises huge questions, because it isn't that the Egyptians didn't know how to write. I mean, they loved writing. Their monuments are filled with inscriptions, except these fourth dynasty pyramids. It's a question that has to be looked at. And the other is, of course, the mathematics in the design. The geometry that comes out of this design produces a mathematics where you have universal constants like pi and phi and the Euler numbers and so forth coming out. You know, we can keep on calling coincidence and coincidence and coincidence. There's a point where you have to stop and say, well, there's something in this monument that needs to be looked at, rather than dispensing it as coincidence. And that's why,
Well, I was going to say, it's like if the pyramid is supposed to be one arc minute in size of the longitudes of the Earth, and the actual size is the scale is considered quote unquote a sacred number, those coincidences or the possibilities of those coincidences become less and less and less. It's the idea that
you're absolutely correct. I mean, the way this book that I've, it's actually called Cosmic Womb, and the way that Professor Chandra and myself have approached it, first of all, it's in two parts. I mean, I'm looking at the pyramid from a completely different perspective than I used to, based on what I call an update in science. Mm-hmm. In other words, I, like many historians and archaeologists and people in the humanities, frankly, we weren't updated as to where science stands today. And we were looking at the past and monuments like the Great Pyramid and various others with a very classical approach. Well, my argument is that we can't do this anymore. You have to update yourself where science stands today and then say, okay, I will look at it from that point of view. I have to, whether I like it or not. It's a bit like quantum mechanics, you know. Nobody likes quantum mechanics because it's counterintuitive and nobody understands it. But we have to accept it because it's there. We have to really, and that's what scientists do. You know, they don't throw something away because they don't like it. So this is the problem with Egyptologists in general, is that they don't like the idea that people are thinking of it, of the Great Pyramid, as anything other than a tomb, and that the Egyptians had perhaps a higher level of knowledge, or even the very controversial idea that there might have been extraterrestrial contact. Of course, they reject this entirely. Well, they're wrong, because scientists today do not reject things like that, because we're forced to contend with it. Having said this, there is no proof that there has been extraterrestrial contact. There is intelligent speculation. And when you look at a monument like the Great Pyramid, you have to look at every aspect of its design, because people tend to, the discussion has been for many years, you know, how did they build it? How did they build it so accurately? And how did they lift the stones? And this was the big discussions and mystery. But what is more interesting is how was it designed? Mm-hmm. Who designed it? And why was it designed this way? Because you start with a design. Like everything that is built, you have to design it first. And for that you need architects. And then when the architects discovered, as he reverse engineers it, he takes the monument as it is and redesigns it literally. Mm-hmm. Well, when an architect does this with the Great Pyramid, and I believe me, I've talked to many, including my brother, who's a top architect, retired now, they're baffled because it contains certain aspects of the initial design that makes it extremely difficult. It looks very simple. People say, well, you know, there's nothing very complicated with the pyramid. Well, true, until you make one design decision, which is not to have a flat-faced pyramid, but with a what we call a concavity. The pyramid has eight faces. It does look like it, but it does have. The minute you do that, you complicate the design enormously. Really, it's a big problem. I had to go into it with architects to realize how big a problem it is. Then, the interior design of the monument with this strange decision of having concavities. The internal design, the spatial aspect of the internal design is very, very complicated. We thought, well, you know, they put a gallery here and they pushed a tunnel there. No, because what has been discovered is that it's designed very, very carefully on a grid system where changes in directions are at very specific points. Mm-hmm. And strangely enough, the whole grid is based on a prime number system. Now, that is very peculiar. I mean, first of all, we didn't think that ancient Egyptians or any ancient cultures were interested in prime numbers, let alone design a monument entirely on prime numbers. The pyramid itself, the outside itself, is based on a 7 to 11 ratio. 7 to 11 are two prime numbers. Now, for people who are not into it, and frankly, I was not into it, but when you get into this, you realize that there is something very interesting here. Because prime numbers are very, very mysterious things when you get into it, factorizing with prime numbers and all sorts of strange things that occur. And it is, in a sense, a language of mathematics that will be used universally. We'd expect, for example, if we ever make contact with an extraterrestrial civilization, to speak in prime numbers, like we do in computers with zeros and ones. Prime numbers are things that you can create messages with. For example, if I take one of the most prolific number that comes in the pyramid is the number 11, which is a prime number. a very interesting prime number. But the 11 square, 11 times 11, produces 121, which is not a prime number. But we get this 121 coming all over this design. The measurements of the shaft, the distance between the two points from one shaft to the other, and so forth. Well, if you tell somebody today, can you prime factorize 121? They may take about 10, 15 minutes, maybe half an hour, but they finally conclude that it's 11 times 11. No problem. But if you tell somebody to factorize something like 1,760, which is the perimeter of the Great Pyramid, I can assure you that'll take a few hours, if not a few days. It sounds simple, prime factorization, but you try it and you'll see. Once you get into this, it's very interesting because you realize that these people were capable of doing calculations that today we would use computers. It's bizarre, but that's what happens. The other thing that's coming up, and I think Nightingale would have spoken a lot about this, certainly many have looked into this, is that we're getting a situation of the egg before the chicken. Mm-hmm. Let me explain this. We're finding that in the design of the Great Pyramid, you can convert their unit of measurement, which was called the royal, well, Egyptologists have called it the royal cubit, mm-hmm. which is very precisely 0.5236 of a meter, or 20.62 of a British foot. You can find in the design of the pyramid that this unit will convert, strangely enough, in certain parts of the pyramid into meters. Now, the meter was not supposed to have been discovered in 1793. Now, we have a problem with this. But the meter is not just an arbitrary measurement. It was derived from knowing the polar distance from the equator to the pole. The French did it in 1793. In other words, if the meter was used prior to 1793, people had to know the dimensions of the planet. That's number one. Number two is that you find that you can correlate the various British units. The nautical mile, for example, is one of the strange things. Now, that's something I've, again, like I said, I wouldn't have touched 10 years ago. It wasn't my thing at all. But the nautical mile, or let's put it this way, 1 degree measured at the equator, 1 degree of latitude, when you convert this to 1 minute of degree of latitude, it is very precisely, we know this from GPS measurements and nautical measurements, it's very precisely 1,843 meters. No argument on that. That's 1 minute of a degree, mm-hmm. measured at the equator. Well, lo and behold, the perimeter of the Great Pyramid is half that value. It's 921.53 meters. Very, very precise. In other words, by intent or by coincidence, the perimeter of the Great Pyramid is half of 1 degree of latitude measured at the equator. Now, that's bizarre because we find the meter in the design, which was found by measuring the polar axis, and therefore we have to ask the question, how the hell did they know this? Or is it coincidence? Okay, we can brush it away as coincidence, but then you move on. And you find that there are other things that crop up in the design. I can go on and on like this forever. So the book is done, well, forever, no, but we found many of these so-called coincidences, and you reach a point where, at what point do you say, well, I have to stop saying coincidence. I mean, at what point do you say coincidence? I'm looking at your cat there.
Yep, she's...
Let me tell you, I'm going to use the cat as an analogy. I mean, there's a cat there on your table. Right?
Yes, yes.
I'm looking, right. Well, what if suddenly another cat appeared on your table, just out of the blues? What would you say?
I would say I have to feed them.
Oh, you have two cats.
But
What I'm trying to say here is that you would say, well, that if you only have one cat, I assume, you would say, well, this is strange, but maybe it's a neighbor's cat that somehow came in, right? I mean, that's, you would try and find an explanation. Mm-hmm. But what if a third cat came in? Then you would say, well, maybe there's a third neighbor, you know, and what if a fourth? What if a fifth? What if a sixth? Where do you stop saying there's something weird going on? Right? Mm-hmm. And what would you say? That somebody's controlling the cats, you know, and sending them at your place, or maybe they're virtual cats or whatever. But you come a point where you cannot explain it anymore. Mm-hmm. You have to accept it that it's not a coincidence. And this is what we've done in this book. All right? So having said all this, and having given you the basis of where the Orion correlation stands, I'm at that point in my career, if you like. Hence why I'm not that interested, frankly, to debate with Mr. Meyer or anybody else, because this is past, this is over. We have to move ahead. We have to move ahead and take it and accept that we're not dealing with a coincidence. We're not quite sure what we're dealing with here, but we're not dealing with a coincidence, and therefore, like we say, the jury is out. We have to look at this seriously, with professionals. The trouble is with this monument that it's attracted all sorts of people and cranks and theories about pumps and levitation and you name it. I'm not poo-pooing everybody, but we have to stick to evidence, we have to stick to facts, and we have to be open-minded, and we have to progress, because if this monument has a message, it looks like it has a message. Mm-hmm. It looks like whoever designed it put a mathematical, astronomical combination of factors that can be read. It's not meant to be read by an Egyptologist. It's not meant to be read by a channeler. It's meant to be read by a scientist who understands how mathematics can be converted into a language, because the universe is literally built with the language of mathematics, if you like. I'm quoting Galileo here. So we have to read it with that language and astronomy. If we're going to speak across space and time at different civilizations, even across one continent and another, and we don't speak the same language, we're going to use mathematics and astronomy. Astronomy to give direction and coordinates, and mathematics to explain what we have in mind. It's like physicists who talk to each other today. When they want to explain a cosmological theory, they will talk mathematics. Otherwise, they'll talk fairy tales, if you like. They'll talk metaphors and analogies. But to really come to the bones of it, you have to talk mathematics. And this is where it stands. We have to move there. We can't keep on arguing, you know, is it Orion correlation, or is it a water pump, or is it an electrical machine? It is. We won't move. We have to contend with what it says, and it has to be read, not theorized anymore. It has to be read.
That is,
there we are.
Well, you know, that is a... That's kind of reframed a lot of how I look at a lot of the theories that are out there, and maybe because I was kind of, you know, looking at the trees and losing track of the forest, as it were. It's an interesting standpoint to reframe everything and just say stick with math, stick with the questions about what it's trying to say, not what it used to do. That brings it back to the language aspect of it. So if, you know, as you said, if we're trying to be able to talk across the stars, you know, any astrophysicists or anybody who seriously theorizes about contact with extraterrestrials that may happen in the future, how would we speak to them? We have to speak to them with math, because obviously our language is not necessarily going to be the same as theirs, and we need to be able to find a common ground. And speaking from how to be able to prove whether we're an intelligent species to somebody that, you know, let's say if their culture is a million years old and they've been crossing the stars for hundreds of thousands, how would we prove that we're above the bugs, you know, on the ground? Well, you start talking prime numbers, and they'll start taking you a lot more seriously, because they understand, okay, well, they understand that aspect of mathematics, and then we have something to be able to discuss.
We have already I mean, we, the scientific community, NASA and various, and SETI and so forth, and various others have already attempted and are attempting to send messages to other stellar systems. We're trying very hard. The language that is used is codified in mathematics. That's number one. But the way for us and them, if they exist, to understand the level of intelligence is to produce a mathematical message that undeniably will, for example, if you send the number 1836, all right, it doesn't mean anything to most people, 1836, what's 1836? Well, 1836 is the ratio of the weight of electrons to the to the core of the atom of a hydrogen atom. It's the same anywhere in the universe. Or if you send a certain frequency or a using a certain frequency, they can read, because you can't know this. You can't know the ratio between electrons and the nucleus of an atom, a hydrogen atom, unless you have developed the science to be able to measure it. And that entails an enormous amount, not just of theoretical science, but of technology. For example, I've always said, I mean, people are looking for evidence of extraterrestrial contact with this planet. I've always said we don't need to find a flying saucer buried under the pyramid or whatever. All we need to find out is a mathematical equation that cannot be known unless you have developed a science to that level. You can't know Euler's number unless you have developed a mathematics, and a very exotic mathematics, let me tell you. And that would imply not just a knowledge, it would imply a technology. We don't need to find, when we go to Mars or the Moon, we don't need to find, I mean, yeah, it'd be great if we find a civilization, but all we need to do is find a scratch on a rock that is artificial. If there is a scratch on a rock that's artificial, that's it. That's it.
That's the
can only
the
be
question.
Done. Or if there is a drawing, or if there is a, or if there is a piece of plastic or steel, right? So this is how you approach this problem. And we're approaching it intelligently, without crazy speculation, saying, okay, open mind, let's look at this monument. Let's forget about all the theories, everything. Let's look at what it is there and extract from it what we can extract from it. And what comes out is, I don't want to repeat all this again, comes out a very elegant geometry that invites us, whether we like it or not, to consider knowledge of the Earth's size and circumference and shape and measurements, and using units that weren't supposed to be known until much later. Fact is fact. Now the question is whether these facts are the result of coincidence or the result of deliberation. They're tending towards deliberation. It's very disturbing to me anyway. But so was quantum mechanics. I mean, quantum mechanics is a very disturbing thing. I mean, I wish I'd never read books about quantum mechanics, because I go around now thinking, my God, you know, I could have atoms in me that are entangled with something else in the universe, and I could be somewhere else. And, you know, it opens up what we are biased, not, and because it's counterintuitive. We have difficulty in accepting that the ancients might have been much more intelligent than we give them credit for, or indeed far more superior than we were. Maybe they had systems of scientific approaches that were very different from ours. Maybe there was contact. Maybe there was contact that is very difficult for us to detect. It doesn't have to be a craft flying from a solar system to ours. We know today that we'll be able to send, we'll be able to download literally a human mind on a laser beam and send it to the stars within 50 or 60 years' time, 100 years' time. So we can extrapolate and say, well, my God, what we'll be able to do if we haven't destroyed ourselves in 1,000 years' time, in 10,000 years' time, in 1,000,000 years' time.
Oh,
this is what, Yeah, well, this is what we have to deal with. This is the truth. We live in a universe that has that age and has that number to deal with. Okay, there you are. I didn't intend to speak so much. What time is it in Canada?
It's 9:32 in the morning. I know if you're in Spain, I know David's in Spain, and my I had the time zone difference off, so I'm guessing you're about 5 or 6 hours ahead, which means it'd probably be about 3-4 o'clock in the
afternoon. It's much earlier. It's 2:30 in the afternoon.
Well, there you go.
No problem. I just had lunch. I'm fully awake.
On my third cup of coffee so far.
Oh, good. Well, I've had mine, and yeah. I mean, I need to state this again. I've done my debating mm-hmm. times. I've done my argument times. I've taken it as far as this thing can go to argue whether we're dealing with a coincidence or a deliberation. I'm talking about the Orion correlation theory. Mm-hmm. I am convinced I've always been convinced, but I've looked very carefully at the analysis of the falsification. I knew this myself, but I'm glad that academics have done it. And this is where it stops. That's it. So people who don't like it, too bad. People who want to take it further, not keep on coming back and saying, look, I will agree and disagree and let's argue and I don't like the way that you measured it. No. We either reject it, everybody's welcome to reject it, or take it further. We can't keep on debating till the cows come home. So taking it further is what I've done now for the last 3 years. I've just finished a book, by the way, with Robert Schock, the Boston geologist. Yes, it's coming out in 3 or 4 weeks' time. And we're looking again at the problem of the Sphinx. We want to take it further. It's enough, the debates. I mean, Schock has been debated like me for the last 30 years. You know, we've got to stop somewhere and say, okay, we're going to move further. We've got to see what is beyond the point that we've reached. And so I've done this with Schock, and like I said, I've done this with Professor Chandra on the Great Pyramid Design. This is the way. You know, people talk about paradigm change and paradigm shift, and we're only going to have paradigm shifts if we produce a big shake-up mm-hmm. in the way that we perceive our universe. Quantum mechanics has done it, or should have done it. It's done it to most of us who have bothered to investigate it. Most people, I'm looking out of my window because I live on the coastline of Andalusia in Spain. I mean, I'm sure most people on the beach have no idea about it. Mm-hmm. But this is a paradigm shift, huge paradigm shift. We're obliged to think of ourselves and the way the physical universe is made. The other is cosmology. We're obliged to consider things that religion didn't want to consider, that culture didn't want to consider. We're obliged to consider that there are other planets out there, that there are other solar systems out there. So this is how we have to look at the world. And therefore, we're obliged to look at the past in a different way, irrespective of the huge resistance that we're bound to get. But this is how we make advancements. This is how we make big changes, big paradigm changes. And those who do not want to follow are left behind, and that's up to them. But debating for the sake of debating and arguing whether Napoleon was right in invading Austria, and so we can go on forever on historical issues. I cannot prove what the Egyptians deliberately intended. All I can say is that we analyze the facts, we analyze the evidence, and it's tending towards a deliberate design, an intelligent design that is far superior than the knowledge attributed to the ancient Egyptians of the Pyramid Age by Egyptologists. That's point blank. So that's where we stand. And we have to contend with this. Egyptologists have to move in that direction.
Mm-hmm. And you've definitely helped me change my perspective on how to be able to approach these types of subjects. You know, sometimes the best way to be able to get that type of, you know, even if it's a smaller paradigm shift, you get it from the people that that have been doing it a long time. That's the whole idea of my show. We're a den of lore. We're trying to acquire new information and new ways of looking at problems. And we also drink a lot of scotch on the show, which is always fun sometimes. I've looked at I've had a conversation with Shock and my attitude as well before at that point was always look at point of view is valid to be able to look at. And he said, no, it's not, it's either it is or it isn't. And I didn't understand that at the time, but with talking with you, it makes it a little more apparent from what position he was actually coming from. So like that is,
well, let me give you one example. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much time we have, of a major paradigm shift, major. And it has changed the way we, humankind, sees itself and sees its surroundings. And that is Copernicus, of course, that he demonstrated in mathematical terms that the Earth is not the center of our visible system, but the Sun is. And it was resisted, it was argued, it was even rejected by scientists at the time. But truth is truth. Truth is not democratic. You don't vote on truth. And even when Galileo came afterwards and had the telescope, and you could actually see, literally see with your own eyes, moons moving around other planets, that even then there was resistance. You will always have resistance. But that's it. You go in the street now, and if you say to anybody, the Earth is a globe going around the Sun and there are other planets, you don't get burnt. Everybody accepts it. It's totally acceptable. It is, that's it. Mm-hmm. Nobody questions it anymore, apart from some flat Earth people that don't want to get mixed up with that. But having said this, there has been a huge, huge, even bigger paradigm shift, which hasn't taken shape yet, which is quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics has baffled scientists by its reality, but also by being totally counterintuitive. You know, we have particles that become waves and then become particles again. We don't get it. Our mind doesn't work this way. We have particles that could be at infinite places at the same time. We have the possibility, by trying to make sense of it, we come up with the many world theories and the multiverses, and we come up with we've proved entanglement. When I say we, I don't mean I'm a scientist, but I'm saying we in general, as a human race. There is experiments going on as we speak on the island of Tenerife where they've actually proved entanglement. You know, you take one electron and that is entangled with another one, move the other one to somewhere else, but they've done it with 150 kilometers distance, and one moves, the other moves instantaneously. We don't understand this. There is no science that can explain it. All we know is that it happens. And we can calculate it. The reason you and I are talking on Skype is because we're able to work it out. You know, and we'll have very soon quantum computers that will work literally on quantum mechanics. We will know how to build them. We can calculate how they work, but we don't understand it. We live in this kind of universe today. It is but it's fascinating because it's opened up all sorts of possibilities. It's opened up the possibility, for example, neuroscience. Mm-hmm. I've been very, very involved in the last 2 years with neuroscience. It's something that I had very little knowledge about, how the brain works, how you and I are talking to each other while there is perhaps 100 trillion calculations being done by 100 billion neurons with 100 or 300, some even say more, trillion synapses firing at the same time, moving my thoughts, my arms, my blood being pumped, my cells being repaired. I'm literally managing a whole micro universe, literally, that is made of atoms, because I'm made of atoms and quarks, and I don't know how it's done. My brain knows how it's done. It's doing it. And therefore, this is who we are, what we are, and the world around us. And we not only it makes it more wonderful to exist in such an extraordinary world and being conscious about it, but we have to look at the past again. We have to say, well, if we know this, why are we being so arrogant saying that our our ancient ancestors couldn't have known it. They couldn't have known it in a different way. Maybe they accessed the human brain, for all we know. Maybe they had means. We know, for example, that today there exists people, I'll name one or two, for example, Daniel Tammet in England, a young man who is in his late 30s, mm-hmm. who can factorize instantaneously huge numbers, prime factorize them. And he does it by thinking of colors. He doesn't know how he's doing it. If you tell him multiply 326 by 3028, he gives you the answer instantaneously. Your brain is doing it right now. It has to do it as you're shaking your head, just a simple movement of shaking your head. Your cat is doing it. Your cat is doing it even much better than us. It can move from one table to the other and balance itself. It knows the laws of gravity.
This one, she's not very good at balance. She falls off of our fence outside very often.
Something is wrong with the brain. But we have we're all equipped the most amazing processor. And this processor is working. It appears to be a lump of flesh, but it's made of atoms and quarks. It's made of the same stuff that the stars are made, the galaxies are made. And it is therefore, and it's because it's made of atoms and quarks, it's behaving with quantum mechanics, not just classical physics. We have to deal with this. You know, this is this is my message whenever I go to conferences now. And first update yourself, then reason where you stand, and then look at the past. Do it properly. And don't poo-poo it by saying, you know, it can't be done, or like Egyptologists are doing. Or worse, come up with crazy theories because you haven't bothered to look very carefully at where we stand with science.
And that's...
Or by the way, let me just say this. I keep interrupting you. That's okay. You have to watch out with me. You have to break in. Huh? But I've had people who made theories about the pyramids who never went to see the pyramids. No, they haven't bothered to go to Egypt and examine these monuments before you make all sorts of theories. You know, I'm referring to the pump one. I mean, the pump one has been... The pyramid can't not hold water, full stop, you know, with all due respect. There's no way you can put water in this monument. You can attempt to put water in this monument. It's going to leak like crazy, right? Mm-hmm. It's full of joints. So all this business about being a pump and being... And besides, I mean... It doesn't make sense. We're looking at a metaphysical monument there, a metaphysical monument designed with a very, very intelligent mathematics that is using a sort of universal language. It is a message.
And I've actually had physicists, or not physicists, but pure engineers, mechanical engineers and architects who have told me said the exact same thing, that it's like, well, if you put water in the pyramid, it will leak. It was not meant to hold water. Full stop. That's what they've told me in that regard. So
yeah. Look, all you have to do is go there. I mean, and have a look. As for power plant and all this, well, I don't want to go into that. Mm-hmm. It is the good thing about the pyramid texts, which are of a generation afterwards, admittedly, but they do speak about the intention, and the intention is. Once you remove all the mythology and the occult messages, but the intention is very simple. They want to take a physical human body and put it in there to somehow convert it and send it to the stars. I mean, that's what they tell us, point blank. I mean, you can read the pyramid text 100 times, but this is the conclusion. It is meant to perform what we see today as a metaphysical task, symmetrical function. Maybe that's all they had in mind. But today, if I go to a theoretical physicist and I say, can I send my soul, my mind, my consciousness to the stars? Any theoretical physicist who has dealt with futuristic science will tell us, well, it can be done, but we can't do it today. Mm-hmm. And the reason we can't do it today is not because we don't know how to do it. We don't have the funds and the technology. It's a bit like saying, let's build a computer, because there's a lot of talk about this. You know, there are programs called the Blue Brain Computer and various other programs going on in Switzerland and other places to build an artificial human brain. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, today, we know how to do it. Well, let's put it this way. First, we have to map the brain and understand how the linkages between the neurons and the synapses are made. But let's assume that we can do it. Apparently, they think maybe in 10, 15 years' time, we'll have mapped the human brain. The next step, of course, is to program it, to give it all the software in order to operate like a living human. Mm-hmm. All right. But if we were to attempt to do it today, we would have a computer the size of New York, apparently. And in order to power this computer, we would require a power plant, a nuclear power plant, to give it the energy required to run it. And we would have a river flowing through it to cool it. This is what would be required to have the equivalent, artificially, of a human brain today. In 50 years' time, like we've made advances in our computers, I mean, the computer 50 years ago was the size of, certainly the size of my apartment. I don't know about the size of yours. And today, we have the same machine, but something like 50,000 times more powerful.
And something that
the size of, that's right. Now, if you had told the scientists 50 years ago that this would happen, some of them predicted, but it would have been futuristic. But we can predict today that we'll be quantum computers are only a year or two away, mm-hmm. that we will have computers that will be thousands of times more powerful and more versatile than we have with the most sophisticated laptop. Having said this, if I go to a theoretical physicist and he will reply to me, yes, you can send, we will be able to send your brain, your consciousness, call it what you like, your mind, to another solar system. In fact, we may even be able to do it instantaneously. We won't even rely on the speed of light. We may be use quantum mechanics, use quantum entanglement. We may even be able to travel through wormholes. If I had listened to what I am saying 20 years ago, I would have said, come on, this is Star Trek stuff. This is science fiction. Today it isn't. Today it is very serious possibilities. This is the world we're in. And this is, it's much more fun. But being an historian, I'm taking this position and say, okay, well, I'm ready now to look into the past. I'm ready to look at these people that I thought were running around with sticks and camels and donkeys. And I'm ready to see them very differently. I want to see what was in the brain, in the mind, in the intention of the designer of the Great Pyramid. Because from what I've investigated, we're dealing with something quite extraordinary here. It's not just some priest in a temple taking a papyrus and drawing a pyramid. It isn't that at all.
Even from a project management standpoint, I do a lot of project management for small businesses and medium-sized businesses as a profession. And the logistics that would need to have been done and the amount of processes that would need to have been created, tested, executed, and then improved upon is, for this type of construction and for those mathematical correlations that are within the construction of the pyramid to have been enacted is insane. I don't even know how they would have done it myself. I know that there are theories for construction based on, let's say, like, you know, in terms of how they could have done those processes. It was a French archaeologist that theorized using the internal ramp to transport.
And that was Jean-Pierre Houdin.
Yes, Houdin. And I found from a project management standpoint, it seemed a lot more plausible than a lot of others that are out there. And it's still a matter of, okay, well, here's a theory of how it could have been constructed from an architect's standpoint, from a project management standpoint. How do you develop that? How do you think up of getting that to work and making sure that it works properly and then, you know, making sure that it doesn't fall apart?
Yeah. Okay, let me give you three things that mm-hmm. most people don't think about. Mm-hmm. I've mentioned the design. Mm-hmm. That an architect could, if my brother was here, he would tell you what really is entailed here. If you're going to design a monument of that kind, for example, I've been I'm a construction engineer. I'm not an architect, but I've been involved with designers and architects. And the planning, for example, of a very large project, like building an airport or a new Vatican or something, a large construction project, the design period would be incredibly long and detailed to finalize something that not only will function, but is of the commission that you got. It has to fit what your client, if you like, wants. You know, it is a very complex thing. As far as an engineer is concerned, you know, you read in books, Egyptological books, you know, they in something like 3 or 4 paragraphs, sometimes even a chapter of how they might have built the pyramid. I can tell you from a construction point of view, a construction engineer, a project even much, much less grandiose than the Great Pyramid would require an enormous amount of what we call preliminaries. Mm-hmm. You really have to prepare for this project. You know, you just don't bring 10,000 people on the site and say, build this monument. You have to prepare their accommodation. You have to work out how they're going to eat, how they're going to sleep, how they're going to go to have the sanitary systems. All sorts of organization. How, and then comes the transporting of the blocks, and comes, it's a very, very complicated process. In engineering, we call this the preliminaries. Mm-hmm. It's long before you lay the first block, long before. And this has not been looked at carefully by Egyptologists. There are certain engineering anomalies about this monument. One of them, which I discuss a lot in this new book, is its location. Its location. This is a monument that had never been attempted before and has never been attempted since. It is, give you some statistics. It contains a mass of about 6 million metric tons. Mm-hmm. 6 million metric tons. Now, to give you an idea, a metric ton would contain something like, about 1,000 normal family cars squished together, right? Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm exaggerating here, 1,000 metric tons. A metric ton will contain about 3 or 4 of these. It contains 6 million of these metric tons. It contains 2.5 million blocks. Now, here is the weirdest thing. As an engineer today, before I even think of placing a monument of that weight and size in a location, I would make damn sure, I would make 200% sure that it is not placed somewhere on the soil that it is placed can withstand the weight. This is rule number one. So we would test the soil. We would bring mechanical engineers, soil engineers, and they would test the soil. And even if it proved to be 100% okay, they will have to have a margin of at least 50% on such a thing. Mm-hmm. Won't take a chance just on 100%. We'll make double sure, because you don't build a monument like this and then it collapses. All right, that's number one. Number two is that even if the soil was good enough, you would not place it where it is placed, where it was placed, because it's near a very, very sharp escarpment. It's very dangerous. It stood there, obviously, it's still there, but it's a huge risk, especially that the risk could have been easily avoided by pushing it another 100 meters further west. Many engineers have commented this. I mean, even today, we wouldn't take the chance. We would push it 100 meters west. You could still see it. There's no problem, but it would be safe. Well, they didn't do that. These people had a very, very different way of looking at the issue, or they had information that we don't attribute to them, that they knew what we Egyptologists said they didn't. That's number one. Number two is you have 2.5 million blocks. Now, you presumably have brick houses where you live in Canada.
Brick over wood frame mostly. But
all right. Well, here in Europe, we don't use that much brick these days, but most of the houses in England are made of bricks. Now, British being British, but even in other countries, they would standardize the brick. We'd call it a British standard brick. I did my studies in England, so I can tell you exactly. It's 12 inches by 4.5.
Okay.
All right. So this is a British standard brick. And when you order bricks, you ordered from a company that has made British standard bricks, and they deliver these bricks. And you would order for a normal house about 60,000, maybe 100,000, depending on the size of the house. Now, that's fine, because the bricklayer comes, and he knows his standard, he knows how many bricks he's going to need to build his wall and so forth. Imagine delivering bricks that are not of the same size or thickness. You drive the bricklayer mad. I mean, he wouldn't know where to start. It would be the most incredible puzzle you'd ask him to put together. And besides, it doesn't make sense. Why would you want to do that? Well, that's what they've done in the pyramid. They've got 2.5 million blocks. Each course is of different thickness, and each block is of different length. And yet, it's perfectly built. Now, to manage this, to coordinate this, somebody on the site, you know, as you say, block this goes there, and block that goes there, and so forth. Today, I mean, if I didn't have a very good computer and software program, I would go berserk to try and do it manually. So these are the things that we have to look about this monument. It's not just big and precise. It is very complex. It's a kind of high-tech Swiss watch, high management organization. Yeah. We're not looking at priests.
Obviously, this didn't come with IKEA-level instructions to build. Or maybe it did, because IKEA uses a lot of pictures.
I have a problem building with IKEA stuff when we buy this. No. This, and besides, having said this, you have to give the instructions. Mm-hmm. You'd expect even the most simple of project today would require, well, we do it on computer these days, but in my days, when I started working in engineering in the 70s and 80s, we'd require documents, drawings, and then the organization and management of the site, you'd expect to find memos, letters, instructions, additional works, loads and loads, boxes and boxes of documents. We haven't found one document, one writing inside or outside this monument about it. Zero. Now that is intriguing, and I'm puzzled that the most banal questions that you ask about this monument are not dealt with by Egyptologists, who keep saying, "Oh no, you're nuts, you're a charlatan, you're a pyramidologist." I'm sure Nightingale has heard it no end. But this is, so I'm coming with a heavy weight here. I'm an engineer, I know what I'm talking about. I've got architects who know what they're talking about. I've got the mathematicians involved with me, and I've got astrobiologists and physicists. You know, we're coming with big guns here. We're not messing around. And we're saying, look, this monument has to be examined, whether you like it or not. Because we'd look like bloody fools, or we won't be here, but in 1,000 years' time, when they discovered that there was something far more important going on at the time, that we had to understand, and we treated it as some sort of tomb, you know, it would be a huge service we do to future generations. It's very much, by the way, suppose that our people like Wolfgang Pauli and a variety of quantum mechanics founders had said, look, I don't want to know about this. I don't want to know about this because it's totally counterintuitive. I'll drop it. You and I wouldn't be speaking with Skype now. Mm-hmm. You and I wouldn't be considering, we wouldn't have cell phones, we wouldn't have scanners, we wouldn't have advancements that we did in electromechanics and technology. So they didn't, because they're scientists. They took it on. They took it on, and it's produced these results. We have to take the past on. We have to take the past on as historians again. It's we have the tools now to do this. And it is a disservice to our ancestors if what we suspect is what they've done.
And that's I was going to say, and that's if our ancestors put a very important message, and again, there are a lot of people who will theorize one way or another, but if the idea is that there is a message in there, if we turn away from the idea that they were trying to send a message forward in time to us, Yeah, I can understand how that could be a very big disservice, because it's like these people potentially spent, well, the, you know, mainstream says 20 years, other people say no, it would have taken a lot longer, but these people spent an enormous amount of time and effort to put this monument there to tell us something, to tell future generations something. And if we turn away and say, no, there is no message, when they spent that effort to put the message, then, you know, that effort and that time is all in vain. And that's kind of sad if we do that.
Well, you just said it. I mean, it's like us sending a message to a distant solar system. And, well, let's put it this way. We've sent the famous message. When was it? In 1976? Is that right?
One of the Voyager, I believe.
One of the Voyagers, yeah. Yes. The disc with that Carl Sagan did. Mm-hmm. And suppose it lands on some, eventually it reaches some solar system and it crashes on a Earth-like planet, right? Mm-hmm. Suppose. And we have a bunch of archaeologists coming and finding this plate and saying, oh, it probably was a ceremonial plate used by our ancestors to do sacrifices on it. And that's it. It goes in a museum. Mm-hmm. What a waste. I mean, what a total misunderstanding of what they're dealing with here. And this is the story of this monument. This monument has been banalized as a tomb. It has been taken to extreme nonsense of being a message from the Bible and the Freemasons and I don't know what. But to look at it from a scientific, mathematical, I don't want to keep saying mathematics, people don't like mathematics, but it is a message written in the language of the universe. That's the right way to look at it. It is, whether it's by deliberation or it just happened to be. But that is what it is expressing. It's expressing a universal language. It's the very language that we would use today with these mathematical constants, by the way, if we were to try and speak to some intelligence elsewhere in the cosmos. We wouldn't speak English or Chinese or French. We would send them a mathematical message that they could unload and understand. Like the film In Contact, by the way, since we're talking about this. The first message would be prime numbers. Mm-hmm. That would be the most likely thing to do, because prime numbers in a series would indicate intelligence. Okay, intelligent message. Then you would send an exotic message to show what you had in mind, and you would use, if you want to speak about atoms, you would have to use Euler numbers, and you would have to use numbers that are known in quantum mechanics, all these various constants that you and I are. I presume you're not a quantum mechanics scientist.
No, I'm not.
Neither am I. But that's the constants they use. You know, the various... And these are the numbers that will be understood and put together to understand what people are trying to say. They won't be talking about sending us poems. They would be sending us information that they think would be useful for us to read them and then to make contact with them. Mm-hmm. It's the quintessential message in a bottle that would be dealt with in an advanced scientific society. We're looking at, now the pyramid is not made of a high technology. I mean, it doesn't contain metal, it doesn't contain steel, it doesn't contain plastics, it doesn't contain what we'd expect of an electronical machine. It's made of stone. But the design implies this knowledge. And therefore it may be not a machine. In fact, I don't think it's a machine at all. It is a blueprint of a machine. It is a kind of three-dimensional blueprint. It seems like it. It begs to be looked at it. I may be wrong, but that's where the whole thing is pushing us to consider. And it looks like a three-dimensional blueprint.
And I think that's actually a perspective that nobody's necessarily looked at. Like, people have said it's a message. People have said, you know, it's actually a machine, but nobody's ever, from any interview, any... any paper, nobody's ever said it's potentially a blueprint. That's kind of groundbreaking from a perspective standpoint.
Well, okay, let's simplify it.
Okay.
Somebody said to a designer, I want you to build me something that is going to convert my physical body and send it to the stars. I mean, that's the instruction. And he comes up with this thing. And when that somebody looks at this plan, this blueprint, says, yes, build it. So something must have convinced them. Now we can poo-poo it and say, well, you know, this is a superstition and God knows what they believed in, and okay. On the other hand, let's look at it. Let's look at it, because they did it. They actually went ahead and built the damn thing. Now, it may not be a machine as such. Mm-hmm. I don't think it is. But it is designed. They somehow wanted to design it this way in order to say that this is how one should do it if we had the technology. Mm-hmm. If we had the technology, we'd do it. One of the good examples, by the way, and a real example, is in 1993, if you recall, a German engineer sent a robotic machine up the Queen's Chamber shaft.
Yes.
You remember that?
I do remember that quite well.
And, right, I was very much involved with this affair. Rudolf Ganterbeck, the engineer who built the robot. And lo and behold, after 4,500 years, he was the first one to literally see with a small camera that he had placed on the machine, this door at the end of the tunnel. Now, it couldn't have been done without the technology of the 1990s. Couldn't have been done. Nobody could go up this shaft and have a look at it. Mm-hmm. They tried, by the way, they tried in the 1980s, they tried again in the 1930s, they shoved all sorts of metal rods and whatever, but they couldn't see. We had finally the video technology to see and report what we saw. So this, it's as if it's designed waiting for the technology to be developed. And if it isn't developed, then we'll wait some more. In fact, we may not even have the technology today to understand this monument and to understand its design. But we're opening the discussion. We're trying to understand it. All right? We may need some other technology in order to comprehend it. For example, precisely now, I don't know if they're still going on, but they were doing the so-called muon scanning. Mm-hmm. Muon scanning, sorry?
I was going to say, yes, I've looked into that. They found a... like a different density near the surface of the pyramid, above the grand gallery, or the entrance to the grand gallery, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. But they're using science of today. Mm-hmm. 20 years ago, we didn't know this science. Or 30 years ago, muons, we didn't know they existed, let alone have the technology to measure them. But here it is. So it's only now that we can do this. So. But it isn't very, very precise yet. You know, there is a very vague possibility that there is. We will have eventually the technology to literally see through this monument. What I'm trying to say is, that's the impression you have from the designer of this monument. They built it at a time when the technology did not exist to build what they wanted to build. They left a drawing, three-dimensional stone drawing. Strange enough, it resembles very much the film of Contact. In other words, that here we get a message from an extraterrestrial civilization in the star system of Vega, mm-hmm. and they send us a plan. They send us, build this machine. You know, and luckily we had the technology. Had they sent it hardly 50 years before, couldn't build it. If we send the plans to build a jumbo jet to a civilization that is hardly 200 years or even 100 years away from us, they won't be able to do it. And same thing, if there's a civilization 300 years away from us and asks us to build what they have built, mm-hmm. we won't be able to do it. So it's a question of when the technology is available. We're looking at a design, that's the impression I have, all right? That's my impression. We're looking at some sort of design without the technology available. Without the electronic technology available. You can't send, at least as far as I know, you cannot send a soul or a human consciousness or a mind using a stone monument. I know that some others will argue through spiritual channeling, and, well, I don't want to get into that.
No,
but from a from a scientific point of view, we're going to need something else. We're going to need an advancement in our computer capacities, map the brain, download it, find the technology to place it on a laser beam, or better still, to use entanglement. So these are long, long way from us, but it will be done. It will be done. We do have the science to develop this. I'll use one analogy. I have to close it.
No, I understand. I understand completely.
But when Chandra Vikramasinghe explained to me panspermia, I had read about it, but it was nice to hear it from a horse's mouth. We gave a lecture about last week, by the way, in London, and people were stunned. I mean, it's nice to hear it from somebody who knows what he's talking about. But he gave a very nice analogy of why panspermia must be the correct answer, rather than saying spontaneous life occurred here 3.5 billion years ago from some sort of non-living organism into organic material, mm-hmm. and developed into us. He said, imagine a junkyard full of debris, you know, with metal and plastic and wires and glass, and it's all a mess. And imagine a tornado passing through it. And when it emerges, it has a built jumbo jet. Mm-hmm. That's what we're saying if life had to be developed spontaneously on this planet. Can't be done. Yeah.
That I've heard of that analogy before, and it actually makes a lot of sense as far as the probability.
It comes from Sir Fred Hoyle. Yes, it's a matter of probabilities. But now we have probabilities to do also with what we know in cosmology. What are the probabilities that there isn't life out there, intelligent life? Well, the probabilities are very, very much low, extremely small, that there isn't, rather than there is. Mm-hmm. You know, we've barely started looking with the sky telescopes, you know, with Hubble and I think there's about four of them, and some land telescopes, which, by the way, are getting more and more sophisticated. You know, for the last 15 years, and in 15 years, in a very small area of our cosmos, we already found something like 4,000 exoplanets and one solar system that is almost identical to ours, or at least very similar, has seven Earth-like planets. And this is very exciting stuff, because when we extrapolate this, we've got a billion, if not more, planetary systems in our galaxy alone, and we're dealing with 500-600 billion galaxies out there. It's absolutely beyond the arrogance to the power of 10, mm-hmm. to say that we're alone here, or that we're the latest, most advanced existence on this universe. You know, it's so this is the way that when you get to the frontier of science, you get to the frontier of cosmology, you get yourself acquainted with quantum mechanics, with neuroscience, that you begin to see things very differently and open your mind to huge possibilities that could have taken place in the past. For Christ's sake, our civilization, as we know it, is only 10,000 years old. Us as human creatures, we can trace them back to what, 7-8 million years old? It's a fraction, it's nothing compared to the 10-15 billion years that we have to deal with the cosmos. And with our own planet, by the way. Mm-hmm. Our planet has existed, you know, quite happily, without the human race, for over 4 billion years. We're just newcomers here. And yet we think we're it. You know, that's it. We've reached the limit. We understand everything. And no, we don't. We have moved amazingly in 10,000 years. But if there are others out there who have hardly a century, let alone 1,000 years, like I was saying earlier, or 1 billion years, then we're dealing with something completely different. Take our chromosomes. Take our DNA. Take our genes. I mean, we have only 1% more than our nearest relative, which is the chimpanzee. Mm-hmm. Now, we've put people on the moon, and we're going to put people, and we're talking through Skype. Chimpanzee can't do that. You know, I mean, can't build anything. It's very clever, but it can't build anything. And yet, look what we've done with 1%. What if there is 1% more out there? Or 2%? So this is how we have to look at things. You know, we have to remove this mantle that we have as a culture, thinking that you know, we've been too much indoctrinated by cultural and religious ideologies that, you know, we're supreme. We're not, but we're intelligent. We're conscious. We can understand. But we need an open mind. We need to unblock ourselves. Okay, Chris.
Honestly,
I was just going to tell you I couldn't come on your show. My wife is shaking her head here, thinking, "Well, there he goes again." You know.
Well, David did mention that you are quite the conversationalist, and again, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for taking the time, Robert.
It's a pleasure.
Have yourself a good afternoon, good evening, and is it okay if I release this show in? As an episode down the road?
No problem at all.
Now,
honestly, I have no problem with anybody who repeats what I say, okay?
No, fantastic. That's wonderful. Just a quick question. When is the next book coming out with you and Dr. Robert Schock? You said it was 3 weeks?
It was due in, it was timed for the 27th of March, but I think they postponed it till mid-April.
Okay.
It's called The Origins of the Sphinx. And it is a update on the Age of the Sphinx debate, but it's looking at some very stunning new archaeological information has come out, which Schock examines archaeologically, geologically, and I've brought in, which I hadn't at the time, text that had escaped my attention, mm-hmm. that fortifies the argument very, very strongly, but also another couple of alignments on the Giza Necropolis, which had escaped attention, which fixes this strange date of 10,500 BC very solidly.
Wow.
In astronomy. So that's the book with Schock, and the other one, well, it's a long time from now, The Cosmic Origins, which we spoke all about this afternoon, is going to be published. It's scheduled for December, and it's actually called Cosmic Womb.
I've seen the book cover on your
Facebook. Ah, well, there you are.
So, oh, you know what? The book was Schock. I'm going to check that out. Thank you very much. Have yourself a good afternoon.
Have yourself a good day, Chris. Nice to have met you. And let me know when you put the show on air.
Will do. Thank you very much, Robert. Bye.
Okay. Bye.